we're not trying to pitch them advisory services or anything like that. You know, we're offering a service much in the same way that Facebook offers a service.
Welcome to AI for Business Growth, the podcast from pioneering artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all business people, from startup entrepreneurs right through to Fortune 500 companies. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech to help you and your business to navigate through and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow businesses.
Today's show is about how to tell if a company is ethical with their artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence and ethics is a really big topic, particularly in Europe with all the AI governance that is going on with the European Commission, as well as with GDPR and lots of privacy concerns. On top of that, ever since the Cambridge Analytica scandal, there have been concerns raised with some of the big tech companies, as well as governments. And so the question of how to manage ethics in the complexity of today's digital technologies is becoming more and more important. So whether you are actually using a company's services or investing in a company, their ethical behavior and the understanding of their ethical behavior is becoming an important consideration. My guest today is Charles Radcliffe, who founded EthicsGrade, which is a company that analyzes companies' ethics in this space and provides helpful ratings to guide people into making an informed decision about the companies that they deal with. Welcome, Charles. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Great. So could you tell me a little bit about your background and what led you to found EthicsGrade?
Sure. So it's really the crossing of two paths for me. My career has been really all in the tech industry and focusing mostly on helping financial services organizations get the most from technology. So I guess it was always going to be sort of destiny that I'd end up doing kind of cutting edge tech work. And then finally that took me to Fidelity, where I headed up AI for the firm, having previously worked for a large German bank, working across a whole bunch of fields, including crypto and quantum computing and virtual reality and a bit of AI as well. So the tech has always been my first love. But my kind of other love earlier in my life was that of philosophy. And the thing that really interested me and drew me to that field was how we kind of organize ourselves in society. We set rules for ourselves. We set laws, and how we, you know, how that really kind of shapes who we are and how we live and how society evolves. So I studied law, but particularly legal history and legal philosophy were the two aspects that most interested me. And the truth is, there was no career path for me going down that route at the time. Really because there was only one option for me, which would have been to go into academia, and I certainly wasn't good enough for that. And so I spent most of my career looking back on those days as pure self-indulgence, really until about a decade ago when I was running a data analytics company, and suddenly I realized that actually philosophy and ethics applied to technology was becoming not just important, but urgent. In fact, I would even go as far as to say this is perhaps the first time in human history that philosophy has been as urgent as it is it is now.
So interesting. I always find people who've done this interesting mix of, you know, different disciplines end up having very fascinating careers where they find that sweet spot in the middle of it all, which it sounds like you've done really nicely. Really interesting. So tell us about EthicsGrade and specifically what EthicsGrade does.
Yeah. So I was at Fidelity and I realized that my colleagues who were making investment decisions needed comparative data on the companies they were investing in, so they could get a judge for themselves as to whether those companies were doing the right things, whether they had the right governance and controls in place. And I realized that data didn't exist in the market around digital ethics questions. It certainly exists around other aspects like human rights and social justice issues, and of course around environmental sustainability. But around these questions of technology governance, the data just didn't exist. And so really that was the core of what we've set out to do with Ethics Grade. And so now 2 years on, or just over 2 years since we started the firm, what we cover is really ESG risks of tech companies, because we understand tech, I think, better than anyone else in this space. And we cover tech risks of everyone else. And obviously that includes things like cybersecurity, data privacy, and of course, AI ethics. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to create a resource which is useful to the research community. So for academics and the media and sort of general users, we want to create our site as a useful free resource. But obviously for investment professionals, people who are using our information to help them make better investment decisions and also to guide their own engagement with the companies they're invested in, it's a paid service.
Very, very interesting. I did read actually in one of your blogs about your watermelon approach. I quite like it. Could you maybe explain what that is to the listeners?
Yeah, well, the credit for that actually has to go to an old boss of mine who back in my earlier career, I was a project manager for a big bank. And he commented that he said, "Charles, you're a watermelon project manager." And I asked him what that meant. And he said, "Well, somehow all of your projects, when you provide the status reporting, they all look perfectly green, but you just only have to scratch the surface to see what you're And that stuck with me. And it struck me that that's exactly, the challenge we have around ESG. And I think what's true is that there's actually very little kind of disingenuous behavior. Organizations do fall over themselves to promote their green credentials. I mean, you only have to open a search engine to see that it's been carbon neutral since whenever. But actually, this covers up, I think, a lot of other governance which we should be expecting organizations to have. And organizations which only really manage a kind of surface layer towards ethics and sustainability, or indeed only manage one issue and ignoring other issues, they're indeed the organizations we call watermelons.
So, you mentioned ESG, and obviously that gets used a lot in terms of when people are looking at companies for investment, etc. Do you think that it is not being analysed thoroughly enough, those kind of things, or it's just missing these extra AI elements, tech elements?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think ESG is being analysed thoroughly. I mean, that's definitely not the problem. But I think there are other issues with the ESG space, most notably the fact that if you have a kind of if you have a model which you're providing to all of your clients, there's a very strong disincentive to want to grow that model, to cover more issues or to cover issues more deeply. But of course, the world is continuing to change. The risks that organizations face continue to change.
Yeah.
And therefore, actually, the demands on ratings agencies to look at issues more deeply or more broadly, it is growing. And so I think that's really the challenge that the ESG ratings industry has, is that there's a disincentive. I think for us, we even notice that challenge even in a very small part of the market. So I mean, we're looking at absolutely areas which are not covered by other ESG ratings businesses because, they see this area as too niche, or they haven't realized it's important. But even within our space, it's something we're very conscious of, that as the space develops, as new research is conducted, as more controversies sadly break, then there's a demand on us to cover more and also to cover things more deeply. We can overcome that issue that exists for other ESG businesses because we have a slightly different approach to the way that we provide data to our clients, in that we personalize the data to our clients in a way that's aligned to their ESG strategies. And we do that through something we call a data-driven materiality assessment.
Okay, interesting. And so one of the things that I find interesting in a lot of the discussions I hear about AI and ethics, it just strikes me that so many people sometimes call some practices unethical, and I can give the examples, but I don't think that they're necessarily planned ethical violations. I think they're just very bad data preparation. So there's that example with Amazon years ago where they did that algorithm for recruitment, and they discovered that they were only hiring men. And so then they went in, they realized that the only data. The only resumes they put in were male resumes. So I think there's a lot of situations like that where it's very biased, but it's because they didn't do their data planning or management correctly. So how do you view ethics as a concept for companies?
Yeah, well, I think this is again an area which we spent a lot of time thinking about before we started. Mm-hmm. And I think for us, when we're dealing with, I mean, we use the word ethics very provocatively in our company name because I think we really want to bring this point to the fore. Other people like to use a kind of euphemism for ethics. We talk about sustainability, but I think ultimately we're talking about the same thing, which is really a kind of subjective assessment of whether an organization aligns to your values or not. And I think the example you gave there about discrimination in human capital management is mm-hmm. very interesting because you and I both, I think, agree that that was an ethical violation, but that's because we value things like diversity and inclusion very highly, and we wouldn't want to create a situation where we're disadvantaging part of the talent pool, the skill set that we're trying to bring into an organization. But in fact, somebody else might disagree with that position and say, no, actually, we want to have people who are the best on a particular measure, and if they all are white men, then that's okay. I don't subscribe to that view, but somebody else might do. And so I think what's important around ethics is to, for me at least, is not to be too judgmental. I think we can certainly influence the conversation by focusing on certain areas other than others, and I think that does help move the needle. But certainly in terms of the clients we deal with, we try and come to them and understand what their priorities are without any judgment. And so some of our clients care much, much, much more about issues such as cyber risks and data privacy, as opposed to the bias and discrimination and the harms that could be caused from not having good governance around data. Mm-hmm. And indeed, other organizations that we deal with carry much more about the environmental risks and the environmental impacts that technology have, such as e-waste or not running efficient technology platforms, or indeed not having renewable energy sources in play. And so for us, we're guided around the subject really by clients. But I think, that understanding of ethics as being an inherently subjective discipline, and also understanding that there can be two different sides to the debate, and often there's almost always two sides to the debate.
Yeah.
And so I think, if we're rating, and this is always our goal, if we're rating, Chinese companies for a Chinese audience, then we should be rating them by Chinese standards, and absolutely recognize that, some things just simply won't fly in other parts of the world. But I think, really that's what we're talking about with ethics. We're about alignment to values and recognizing that subjective.
Interesting. And so what elements of AI ethics does Ethic Grade cover? Because you've covered quite a few different things there.
Yeah, so we cover what we call six dimensions. So we look at things as dimensions, which is really just a way of cutting the data. So yeah. I think one of the things we recognize is actually very hard to build a taxonomy. And when you're looking at a particular issue, it might actually play to multiple dimensions or multiple issues. So we try and get down into the specifics of governance, and sometimes that gets quite technical. We look at something we call model drift characteristics, and we look at how an organization might measure the performance of its models over different time horizons. And other aspects are much more high level in terms of whether there's board level accountability for the controls that are in place. What we're really looking for is whether an organization at a board level has set out a goal, and whether that goal is translated down to the people on the ground, and whether the people on the ground are able to solicit the feedback from the stakeholders that organization is going to be impacting through its technology, and has a process to build that stakeholder feedback in. I mean, at the highest level, that's what we're looking at. We cover about 300, at the moment, it's 283 specific questions. I'll say that some of those can go quite down into the detail. Not mm-hmm. all of those questions be relevant to all organizations. So obviously questions when we look at content moderation wouldn't be relevant to a company that makes dental hygiene equipment. So the materiality of the questions really differs, and also it differs based on the the maturity of the AI strategy that the organization has. And I think also that's the other thing that we've learned in the last 2 years, that our data is quite a good indication of. You know, we're really only focused on governance and controls, not just of AI, mm-hmm. but of technology systems more generally. But I would say 40% plus of our work is on AI. But actually mm-hmm. what that data becomes is a proxy measure for the sophistication of a digital strategy. And that's really, I think, an interesting story, particularly in this sort of post-pandemic economic recovery that we're in at the moment.
Yeah, interesting. And you're using AI to track AI ethics, are you? Just checking.
Well, yeah, so there's still quite a lot of sticky tape and pipe cleaner in our own AI system. So I can I can say it probably wouldn't pass even our own governance in terms of the controls that we'd want to see. I mean, machine learning, I mean, our approach is very much a human-first approach. There's really two ways mm-hmm. of doing ESG. One way is to kind of consume the fire hydrant of data that exists on the internet and then use that to build patterns and to infer things. We decided not to go down that path. There's other people who do that and do that perfectly well, and we decided that wasn't appropriate for us. What we wanted to do instead was, you know, human analyst-driven research, because we feel that the subject that we're dealing with, the subject we're grappling with, is something where human insights and human judgment is actually a very important part of the process. Sure. And then really the machine learning that we've brought in and the automation that we've brought into our process is there to provide scale to what is otherwise a human-driven process. And so today, our limitation is really we only cover a very small set of companies. We cover, I think at current count, 302 companies is all we cover. Our goal is to absolutely cover 30,000, which, you know, some of the bigger ratings agencies would be covering. And we'll get to that scale using more automation and machine learning. Sometimes perhaps people find it unusual that a guy that was once the head of AI at a big investment firm is taking the approach that we're taking. But I think understanding the issue and having run an AI governance program for a large organization, you know, we felt very strongly that this was the way that we could maintain quality, even if it made it more difficult to build scale in the short term.
Well, you're human first, but you're using AI, you're leveraging AI within it as well. So interesting.
Exactly. And I think I think ultimately, and I keep saying this to my analyst team, I think ultimately most of what they do, a machine will be able to do just as well, or should be able to do just as well. Because a lot of what they do is searching, hunting, looking for particular data points, which, you know, frankly, a machine can do just as well. I think where human judgment will always be, never say always, but
no, be careful with that.
That was a trap. But I think right now, from the perspective I've got today, the place where I can't see a machine providing any value or any use to the process is in terms of asking the questions. So I mentioned there's 283 questions that we look at the moment. That list grows, and that list grows every time there's a controversy, every time something goes wrong. We look at what has gone wrong, why it's gone wrong, and then try to understand what questions we should be asking of the companies we're covering so that we can get an early warning of these things going wrong in the future.
Yeah, that's good.
So I think that's one part of the process where I think our analyst team should always be focused. And hopefully the rest of the work, the research work, machines can do.
You can,
And then the final part of the process, we run what we call a red team, which is part of our quality assessment. So when we do our coverage, when we do our research, the research goes back up to the team, and basically the person who covered the company has to kind of defend the research they've done. The rest of the team play devil's advocates and challenge them on the work. And that's a really great way of us ensuring quality and ensuring also a consensus in terms of how we and consistency in how we look at things.
Yeah,
that's something I think also is a place where human judgment will be reserved. And so if we can build a system where the humans do those two things and the machines do the bit in the middle, I will be delighted. That's what we're aiming for.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. Now, you said you covered around 300 companies so far. What industries have you covered so far?
Yeah, great question. So we started off thinking we would only be covering tech companies. So we thought this would be a universe of like 50 firms. But then we were fortunate enough to do a pilot with a a large investment manager, which gave us some data and some insights in terms of their biggest investments. And suddenly we realized that actually they were very interested in oil and gas and big tobacco and all sorts of things which you wouldn't classically have an ESG company look at. And it struck us that actually, you know, while I have views on the oil and gas industry and I have certainly strong views on the tobacco industry, it's actually very interesting that if, you know, Philip Morris, for example, were to create a very, very strong AI governance program and, you know, had real world-class controls around its use of automation and robotics in its manufacturing process, then actually that's something, that's an insight we would want to learn.
Yeah.
And we would want to bring out as an example of best practice for other firms and other industries to identify with. We didn't find that, by the way, just in case anyone's
okay.
But we felt actually we could have a bit more, I guess, permissiveness to look at other industries where perhaps an ESG company wouldn't want to stray because we're coming at this from a very specific lens. And I think that's really helped us. So today, I think, at the top of my head, I don't know, I think it's like 22, 24 industries we cover. But it's really quite eclectic from big tobacco and big oil all the way through to automotive and mobile phone companies and telecoms and banks, obviously, retail, travel. So it's quite an eclectic mix. And then we obviously monitor when people come to our website and search for a company, we monitor who they're searching for. We record that. And if we suddenly see a lot of hits for a particular company in a particular industry that we haven't covered before, then that's a good clue that there's something to look at. The one that we've just added is mining. We didn't look at extractive industries until only a few months ago. And I think that's been really interesting because we've seen some organizations like Anglo American, for example, who've got, quite an interesting approach to digitalization. They've certainly thought about a lot of these things, where you've got other organizations like Glencore who seem to be, falling behind where it comes to digitalization and the use of technology and thinking through the implications of that. And so, if you're looking at those two industries and charting a path, looking at those two companies and charting a path forward in terms of how might those organizations' success play out over the next 5 to 10 years, my bet would be that the companies who digitalize the most and the most successfully, and I think those are two different things, by the way, are the ones that will win. And so based on the research we've got, when we're showing, an industry like that, I think we're able to have some predictive power into saying which organizations are the ones that are going to accelerate and move ahead.
Interesting.
Even though they're not tech companies, which is great.
Well, I remember, I think it was last year, you did some pharmaceutical companies and you've done quite a few. And I did a LinkedIn post because at that time, and I think it was Merck Serono that was the highest ranking out of all of the ones you'd done at that time. I mean, I'm sure that may not be the case now. But because they rated so highly, then other pharma companies were looking and saw that they weren't ranked as highly. And so I got so many people contacting me from pharma companies saying, what can we do to improve our ranking? And I found that very interesting. And I'm just wondering if when you do rankings, if the companies that don't get good rankings reach out to you and ask what they could do to improve it.
Yeah, I mean, let's come back to that question on Merck. Merck have been consistently top three of the companies we've covered since we started. And I think there's some good reasons why that is. And we definitely have people who have not been as happy as Merck with the with the results. Quite candidly, the vast majority of companies that we cover just ignore us and pretend we don't exist. So we don't get to hear. What we do is we send a scorecard to each company based on the information that we have done in the public domain. And we send it to usually about 8 of the top executives plus the chairperson of the company, because we feel that that's the person who ought to be picking up the mantle if no one else is. As I say, we often don't hear back. But what's very interesting is when we do send those out, we often can see a lot of activity on our website, a few days later, as those executives are dialing in from home and wondering what this ethics grey thing is all about. And so, we see that activity and we can obviously use all the analytics tools that big tech give us. So we have a clue as to which organizations are looking at it, even if those organizations haven't responded and contacted us.
Yeah.
Those that do respond, I think typically are worried that this is some front for us selling consulting services.
Okay.
And I think we have to work a little bit harder than we would want to at reassuring them that, you know, we're not trying to pitch them advisory services or anything like that. You know, we're offering a service much in the same way that Facebook offers a service. You know, we're trying to build the best platform we can to provide them value. In our case, we're providing them benchmarking on their peer group so that they can feed that back into their strategy. In Facebook's case, they're providing connectivity services for messaging, etc. But we do that free of charge because ultimately what we want is we want the insights into what's really going on inside the organization, because those non-public information is really useful for us to be able to get a really glean how much we are seeing of reality in what they're disclosing publicly and how much is going on behind the scenes. And it's that insight that we then use when we provide our research to our clients who pay us. So I think reassuring corporates is always a hard part. But then once that reassurance has been given, we've generally found the reception pretty positive. And I think now we're recording, I think we've got about 60 of the 302 organizations actually using our platform to some degree or other in making disclosures, which I think after two years is pretty good. But obviously, a small start on a very long journey that we've got to go forward.
That's really good. Do you find...
Just one thing, that we've had one very angry response.
Oh, really?
Which I should tell you, and I won't mention the company's name.
Go on.
No. But I'll tell you why, because it came from the general counsel, and it was so fast. We actually sent it electronically, the scorecard and our covering letter. And they're based out on the West Coast, and it was the fastest response we ever had. It was certainly the most angry response we ever had, and it was from from the general counsel, and the response from him was, what you're doing is just not relevant to us and our business, and you know it, and therefore we will be expecting you to be putting in writing that you will not be publishing this information on your website. So I mean, that was pretty strong. What's the most surprising was that came from the general counsel of an online dating company. and to me, looking at the governance of their algorithmic systems is absolutely relevant to them and their business. And we felt it was absolutely something. And we are still stunned that online dating is, of all the industries we've looked at, is absolutely the worst in terms of the level of controls in place, the level of transparency they provide on those controls, which, given the role they play in society, is an absolute shocker.
Wow,
anyway, we didn't get sued by them yet.
That's good. Touch wood quickly.
Yeah, never say never.
Well, you know, you've got a good legal background there, so you should be doing everything right. Do you find big differences? So that's very interesting. So you said the online dating one is typically quite poor. I would imagine, I'm sure it's not across the board, but pharmaceuticals probably fairly okay because we've got so much legal compliance regulations that we have to adhere to. Do you find kind of industries kind of group in a kind of cluster, or do you think it depends on the individual company?
I don't think we have enough data to be able to say this for sure. So that's going to be my kind of caveat here. And I'll say this, we don't cover many online dating companies. And so maybe there are some which are just amazing. But what tends to guide us is, you know, obviously we cover a small number of companies. We haven't got the capacity to cover more at the moment. So what really guides us is whether a client is paying us because they're interested in a particular company. The reason a client would pay us to look at a particular company is because that they must surely have an AI strategy or digital strategy which their investor is interested in. I'm not saying concerned about, but certainly interested in understanding how that stacks up against their peers. So we've covered a lot more pharmaceutical companies, and there's definitely a spread between those where we detect kind of almost nothing to those like Merck, where we actually think they've got some really good controls. We think that industry, the pharma industry, we think there's actually some really good reasons why they're good at this stuff, why some of the organizations that we've covered are up there. And we think there's some, obviously, some sort of historic problems that industry has had that's caused it to build governance muscle in some areas. And I think they've just translated that governance muscle really well to digital ethics. So that's my kind of caveat. I don't think we have enough data to be able to really answer this for sure. But there definitely are industries. And I would say there's sort of two trends. Regulated industries, so financial services and pharma are two which, you know, clearly stand out. And also industries where there's challengers versus incumbents. What's really interesting is it's the incumbents that stand out over the challengers. And that was really interesting for me coming from the financial services market, where I spent my entire life mixing and hanging out with fintechs and working with large banks and you know, investing in or buying fintechs or buying their services and implementing them. And I always got the sense that fintechs were much, much more aware of the sort of emerging tech kind of problems that people might face, like, you know, bias and discrimination from AI systems than the big banks. But actually, we don't detect that at all in our research. We get the sense that actually larger incumbent organizations who have market share to defend are actually maybe a lot more cautious. And maybe that's why they're slower at adopting this stuff. Because actually their governance really weighs them down. Whereas the upstarts, you know, they will move fast and break things. And sometimes
Interesting. What about, so that's across industries. What about across countries? And I think I know the answer. You don't have enough data. But I'm just checking.
Yeah, that's the lawyer in me. I have to caveat every answer. No, we don't have enough data. Again, we can give you a strong hunch as to what our data is showing. So one thing we were surprised by, we've got really good coverage of the Swiss market. Because we cover the top 50 Swiss companies by virtue of one of our clients. And so so one of the things that's really interesting about the DACH region, the German-speaking world, is that there's a lot more activity around something we call corporate digital responsibility than we see in this English-speaking world or the Francophile world. So that's something which we thought would mean that actually within the largest 50 Swiss companies, we would just see them break away compared to other geographies. That wasn't the case. That was not the case. So there's definitely a lot more kind of thinking and talking in sort of civil society circles in the German-speaking world that hasn't yet translated through to corporate activity. My bet is it will. And my bet is over the next 3 years, we will see Swiss companies outperform European companies, EU-based companies, because I just think there's just more going on in that market, and I think that will translate through to corporate action in that sort of time frame. The other thing that we see sort of very generally, and I think this is a cultural thing, and I'm probably going to offend lots of people with this massive overgeneralization here, but one thing we detect is that when we deal with American-headquartered organizations versus European-headquartered organizations, there's always a risk that we might overinterpret what an American organization is doing, because we get the sense that American organizations tend to be a little bit more comfortable with talking aspirationally about what they intend to do as opposed to what actually they're working on. And so a couple of times we found ourselves, you know, giving credit where credit probably isn't due and then having to downgrade. And we've seen that between American headquartered organizations versus European. And we think the same is true between Western organizations and those headquartered in Asia. We think Asian organizations tend to be quite silent on the governance that they've got in place until it's quite robust and well-defined and well-developed. Mm-hmm. So that's a very interesting observation. It's nothing more than an observation. And I think as we build more data out, we'll hopefully be able to validate it. But of course, we're looking at, you know, our clients are... Yeah, all of our clients are Western so far. I mean, we would absolutely love to work with a Middle Eastern organization or even a Chinese or Japanese organization, because I think coming back to my other point about ethics, bringing their perspective on what good looks like and what's important for them into our research model will also help us understand better whether, for example, Japanese companies, and one would assume this is true, that Japanese companies align to Japanese values better than European companies align to Japanese values. And so, but that, we don't have their data on that. And I don't think really anyone has that data in that way, because I don't think anyone else is looking at these things in the same way that we are.
Interesting. I remember many years ago, we used to do collect data for a machine learning model we were doing, and we were looking at all pharmaceutical brands in a particular category, say, you know, cholesterol or whatever. And I remember comparing Japan and the US just because we had the same client in both those markets. And the Japanese doctors had very different values compared to the Americans. So, for example, when a new drug came to market, the Japanese doctors were most concerned about safety because it had no history, whereas the American doctors were most concerned about whether it was effective. You know, safety was important, but it was a few down, whereas the Japanese ones, it was safety and then efficacy was a few down. So each culture seems to have, you know, in each sector, different things, that different weightings, even though a lot of the values are the same, but the weighting is slightly different. It's interesting.
I'm sure that's true. And I'll go a little bit further to say that I also think it's an individual thing. I think there's definitely a kind of, I think we have a predilection. I mean, I'm a product of my upbringing and the society I live in, and I definitely have predilections, but I think they're kind of fairly common to people like me. I think the data analytics industry has been built on kind of proving that people like me do things like people like me will do. But I still think there's a lot about individuality here. And so that's really the goal, is, you know, can we provide data, you know, if for example, we were to work with someone like Nomura, you know, can we provide data to Nomura that's really tailored to their values as an organization? But ultimately, can we help Nomura provide sustainable investment opportunities that's tailored to their clients and reflecting the individuality of their clients' needs? That's really the goal. So I think there is even going to be regional difference. But the way that ESG models up until now have been built, they tend to be very top-down, expert-driven, and very kind of market-orientated, which is a blunt instrument. Yeah. You know, you can't look at all American companies as being homogenous. Something that's built in the Deep South is going to be very different culturally to something that's, you know, grown up in Seattle.
Yeah, for sure. And so for the companies that get low ratings, is there kind of general areas of concern that you see across the low rating companies, or does it vary dramatically?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's some companies we just don't have enough data to be able to even have a stab at where they are. Yeah. So they're the ones that get the NR rating, because we just, you know, we can't tell enough. And it generally means that they haven't thought about this, I would say, and they haven't realized it's important. But it also could mean that they have just decided consciously that they do not want to be transparent about any of these things, but they might have really great first-class governance. I personally think transparency is a quality and a feature of good governance, but I appreciate there are other views on that point. So the ones that get the NR rating, I would, on our website, I would say treat with some caution, that we just don't know enough.
Okay.
The ones that get the R rating, yes, I would say that we're detecting that, you know, there's some evidence of things in place, but nothing that, not sufficient for us to kind of want to give it a grade.
Yeah.
Above that, a D grade is really like a pass, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, scraping along probably is kind of acceptable, but no more than that. And I think what's really a shame is that a lot of the big tech companies, you know, particularly, I mean, one of the things that came out when we launched was there was a great piece in TechCrunch about Facebook, and it said, you know, ethics grade, new British startup rates the ethics of tech companies and gives Facebook a C. And I had a whole barrage of abuse from people that said, how on earth did you give Facebook a C? It's the most atrocious organization on the planet. And you clearly don't know what you're doing to have given the company that strong a rating. And I turned around and said, but that's their core business. Like, all of the stuff that we're looking at is central to what they do. So from my perspective, a C is abysmal. Because, and this is why I think Merck is so impressive, because they're not a tech company. Yeah. And yet they do a lot of these things really well. From my perspective, at least, or from our perspective, from the ethics group perspective.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for me, I think you've also got to look at, you know, how central is this to the business of the organization? I mean, that's why I think things like online dating is a real concern. And other industries that we're starting to get into are things like med tech and ed tech. You know, if there's enormous opportunities, I think, to increase the quality of life and the quality of people's social mobility through the use of technology, but with extreme caution that we could also get a lot of things wrong. And those organizations, regardless of whether they're small or well-funded, well-capitalized or growing fast, you know, they absolutely need to have good governance in place.
And would, for companies that get like a D, a C or a D,
yep,
would, what are the kind of steps you could recommend that to help them improve?
Yeah, so, I mean, the first thing is to get in touch with us and have a conversation with us, because even though we're not trying to sell to them or pitch them, you know, we absolutely want to try and help those organizations understand what we think is important. And so, you know, we're looking, you know, so we're the kind of the supply chain here comes from investors. Investors set their expectations. And so far we've had Federated Hermes, Ethos, Fidelity International, and HSBC are the four investment organizations who've set out their expectations around the use of these technologies. And I think the HSBC one is really interesting because while the use of AI, I believe, can be generally applied to every industry, HSBC is specifically focused on human capital management, so the use of AI in HR, which absolutely applies to every industry.
Yeah.
And so really every company on the planet should read HSBC's expectations paper. And so what we're doing is we're kind of translating that into as a scorecard. And so I think we're able to speak, you know, a translation service between what we're seeing investors demanding, what we're seeing academia and researchers expecting as best practice, what we're seeing in the market from other companies, and then what we think is important for that firm. So we give those insights free of charge, because we want to be helpful, we want to drive impact, we want companies to engage. And I think that's why we've been successful at getting 60 sign up on our platform, because, you know, we've meant that very genuinely. The next thing for a company to do is then to provide the information to us via our platform, or to publish more transparently in the public domain. Of course, you know, our preference is always for a company to be more transparent, but we appreciate there's some reasons why an organization might not want to be talking about the inner workings of its governance. What we then do is we then provide the company with what we call a benchmark. And that benchmark is a detailed rating, which shows it a lot more insights in terms of how it's faring against its peers, and a lot more detail than we publish freely on our website. And having previously run an AI function for a large financial firm, what we've designed that benchmark to be is something that would hopefully be useful for that person to then take back to their boss and say, hey, I need some money to do X, Y, and Z, because X, Y, and Z is important. And that person's probably already been saying that X, Y, and Z is important.
But now they have something that they can
now
show.
They've got something in their hand. Exactly.
Wow.
So, and then, of course, there's lots of consulting experts out there, individuals, freelancers, and also the big four, who can then help the organization do the doing. And then hopefully at the end of that process, they'll come back to us and we will reassess them. And then we can show them how they're stepping towards better. And we're definitely seeing this over the last 12 months. We're seeing organizations who are really making concerted efforts. Just recently, Xiaomi, the Chinese mobile phone company, they had a lot of controversy last year, sadly. They've done a lot in response. It remains to be seen whether that's a sustained response to the controversies, but they're definitely thinking and working towards this. And I think our data and the trends are showing whether that works in the long term or not.
Interesting. So interesting, because I just feel that the service that you're offering is so helpful for the companies themselves. I mean, it's great for, you know, if you're dealing with a company or you're investing in a company, but actually for the company themselves as well, it's a huge service, because every company wants, I would assume, wants to be as ethical and, you know, transparent as they can be. And this at least gives them all the parts of what they need to look at if they're not, you know, doing the best they could be.
Yeah, not every company. Okay. not every company. We've definitely had the door slammed in our face in a few times, but
really?
not as unceremoniously as that online dating business I mentioned.
Yeah, okay. Wow. So, and it's free for anyone apart, and I guess you're selling it to investor companies, but everyone else can access it free on your website.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what might change in the future. I mean, one thing for sure, we don't have the scale to manage the conflicts of interest that would come from providing a paid service to corporates.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that would be a threshold that we would need to reach before we could even consider doing so. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, we don't want to create any frictions for people to use our data. And, you know, particularly what our goal is that academics and journalists find stories within our data and use that, because that really helps amplify our message.
Yeah.
But a ton, I mean, obviously, we look at the traffic that comes to our site. A ton of the traffic that we've had over the last year have just been, you know, I think ordinary people, ordinary consumers who are just interested in this space. So not experts at all, but people who are just kind of reading one level below the headlines and just wanting to kind of see what's going on behind the scenes. They're searching on their favorite search engine and coming to our site. And that's really great. And the other great usage that we've seen is around supply chain. I mean, this was not at all a use case that we thought about when we started, but we've seen people use our data as part of their procurement process, to kind of make comparative judgments between organizations. That's definitely a service that we could monetize or build on in the future. But frankly, it's better for us, and I think better for everyone, if we try and enable that without creating any frictions, because hopefully that in itself acts as a nudge to organizations to put their controls. And obviously, what's interesting about, you know, we look at, I say, ESG risks of tech companies and tech risks of everyone else. It's really the tech companies that people are kind of diligencing using our platform. Because if you're a large pharmaceutical company or consumer goods company or retail business, one thing in common between those three companies is you're probably using Amazon or Microsoft or Google services to be able to provide your own products and services to your clients. And so it's great that people are using our data for that.
That's really cool.
Oh, and one more thing, jobs. That's the other thing. That's the other thing that's really changed in the last 12 months is I think there's a lot more scrutiny when people are moving into new roles and looking at beyond what they're seeing in the marketing and beyond, and so that's another
company. Interesting.
Yeah. And so people like Glassdoor do a great job of looking at culture.
Yeah.
But I think we see something slightly different. And again, what that develops into, how we might provide that as a service or product even, I don't know. I really don't know. It's something I'm just throwing out there. But we definitely know, we can see in the data that people are using our research for that purpose. And that's just really interesting.
That's nice, because I guess that shows a growing awareness amongst everyone that they want to work for companies that are ethical and responsible. So
Exactly.
Well, for anyone listening who wants to see what companies are doing, head over to ethicsgrade.io and you will be able to search by company. You can start looking at what EthicsGrade are doing and even maybe request specific companies. So thank you so much for your time today, Charles. I've really enjoyed this. I find this whole area really interesting, and it's just becoming more and more important. So thank you so much for your time.
I'm really super happy to have had this conversation, and thank you for having me, and hopefully we'll talk again on the subject maybe in a year or two when we've got a bit more data and I can tell you a few more juicy stories.
Yes, I look forward to the juicy stories. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Business Growth with Dr. Andre Bates. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your business, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating wherever you download your podcasts. For more information on the subjects covered in this episode, links mentioned during the conversation, or to connect with Dr. Andre, click the link in the show notes now. Plus, make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.